Welcome to the very first Senior Statesman of Virginia Zoom meeting. Very much appreciate everybody joining us today. We're thrilled by the large number that we're going to have eventually. See, a couple folks haven't yet signed on. As you know, the Senior Statesman of Virginia has been doing programs like this in person for almost a quarter of a century, but this is our first Zoom attempt. All questions we'll go through the chat box, which is generally in the bottom of your screen, although it occasionally will show up at the top of your screen in a toolbar. If it doesn't show up either place, put your cursor on the screen, and it'll show up either at the bottom or the top. The way that's going to work today is the speaker will have a conversation with the moderator, Peyton Williams, who is a director of the Senior Statesman. They'll have a conversation for about 20 to 30 minutes, and then we'll have full Q&A with the chat box feature. So that will start approximately 2 o'clock. As you can see, your audio is turned off. The speaker is asked to have our pretty pictures up, so I'm going to ask you to turn on your video one. And without further ado, let me introduce our moderator, Peyton Wilson. And before I do that, I want to mention that we're going to do this again on June 10th. It'll be our very popular General Assembly report. We already have a delegate, Hudson, Runyon, and Ferris have already committed to that Zoom meeting on the second Wednesday at 1:30 in June. Peyton, it's up to you.
Thank you, Rich. And I'm not an alias today. I'm sorry, Rich, because you call me Wilson rather than Williams.
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm sorry.
That's right. I want to introduce today Mike Signer. I've known Mike for a number of years, although I've known him long enough to have used an email address that he hasn't used for years. It's the one that popped up, and so I kept using it. Done that with a couple of other people over the years, as you can imagine. The key part with Mike is that he was the mayor of Charlottesville from 2016 to 2018, which of course included the Unite the Right march on the 12th of August in 2017. But part of how he got here, some of his background, he was raised in Northern Virginia, went to high school up there at what was then Washington Lee, now Washington Liberty, went to another school, I'll remain nameless, for college. I tease a lot. He got his PhD in political science, in particular in policy at Berkeley, and then got his law degree back here in Charlottesville at the university. He's written two other books. One is Demagogue, The Fight to Save Democracy from its Worst Enemies. Yeah. And the second one is...
Well, I'm looking for a place. Here it is.
The second one, my handwriting is atrocious. Forming Madison, The Extraordinary Origins of the Least Likely Founding Father. Some of his other achievements, working on the Obama campaign, being a counsel to Mark Warner when he was governor. He was a founding member of the University of Virginia Coalition for Progress on Race, which later established the University of Virginia Law School's Center for Study of Race and Law. That was when he was down there. He teaches classes, or was teaching classes at the university. I'm not sure right at the moment whether you are, considering how
long right
we're doing these days. But he has taught a number of classes here at the university in leadership and also at Virginia Tech. And I think that is enough talking about his accolades. Since we are limited on time, I want to get going on our discussion. And the first question, which I thought would be appropriate, is how did you come up with the name for your book? because cry havoc. Of course, it's backwards probably to everybody.
No, it's fine.
Charlottesville and American democracy under siege. Cry havoc is, I mean, havoc is usually what's cried by the person attacking rather than the besieged. And so I was curious as to how that came about.
All right. Well, thank you. Thank you, Peyton. And I really appreciate being with you all. I have been with, I've met with a senior statesman before, and I think I've been a couple times over the years. And it's just great. And this is like these, you know, the whole book talk now and series and tour has gone online. And so there, we can send around a few more things. There was a talk that I did at Politics and Prose, which Peyton saw in DC. So I, you know, bear with me as I'm figuring out this new reality and ways to talk about the books, but this is significant because everybody here is a local. So you all will have your own experiences, these events. And, so I want to be, you know, sensitive to that in the questions, afterward. So the title, it's a great question. The title was a moving target for a long time. The ultimate title, Cry Havoc, was suggested by my editor. The initial title that I wanted to go with, my wife had come up with, and she had also come up with the title for my last book, Becoming Madison, which I loved. And it was, the title we liked was Notes from the Crucible. And then there was going to be this whole unfolding. And I do hope everybody, I hope you buy the book and that you can listen to it. There's an Audible version, which is wonderful. You can buy the Kindle version. You can get it on Amazon. It'll be delivered. It just takes another couple of days now. But in the book, there's a lot of thought about what's the best metaphor to capture what it was like for all of us, what it was like in my seat as mayor, and firestorm. I talk in the very beginning about what is the best metaphor to capture what this experience is like. And I talk about natural disaster metaphors and hurricanes and earthquakes, but that landing on this one of a firestorm, because fires can be man-made but they can also produce, they can produce growth afterward. And that's one of the arguments in the book. So there's, you know, like slash and burn agriculture, you can, the ashes can fertilize growth afterward. And then this idea of a crucible, you know, you can have ingots of wisdom produced after this searing, in most respects, horrible experience. So that was the original title, and we went back and forth for a long time. And then my editor came up with this one out of the blue, and I initially had the same reaction that it seemed it's a citation from a Shakespeare play, and it's traditionally in the Shakespeare context is a battle cry, cry havoc. But as I thought about it, and I thought about why over two or three days I sat with it, and the reason that it started to really speak with me and that ultimately became a guidepost toward the book becoming what it became was the idea of havoc. So the topic of the book really is the unfolding of havoc. And the reason my editor liked this is the book is about Charlottesville as a microcosm for what's happening in America right now. And my experience in a leadership position is a microcosm for what leaders in all kinds of crises face. Political context, business context, how incredibly challenging it is to try and lead and try and get things done and make mistakes and grapple with a whirlwind in some ways. And havoc, as I kind of pondered this, it kept on being the right idea for what the book was about. And then the word cry in it actually ended up to me feeling much more literally because there was so much pain and so much suffering and so many tears shed. And so ultimately the title to me became not kind of, tethered to the Shakespeare reference of a army about to lay siege to another city. It became about what the experience was, from my seat of dealing with the events, wrestling with them, trying to learn from them, as this whole, you know, 3 years unfolded. And so, and the subtitle really is meant to spell that out, because it's Charlottesville and American Democracy Under Siege. So the havoc is kind of the forces that are laying siege to democracy itself. So that's a very long-winded way of trying to get into what the book, but it ended up, it was interesting, the title kind of came like between maybe the third and fourth drafts of the, ultimately there are probably seven drafts of the book. And it became kind of a beacon. Like, it helped me tie together a lot of the different parts of the book and the themes, and connecting the personal with the political and the city with the nation. And this, I mean, the biggest theme of the book is that, and this goes back to a lot of what I said up there from the dais, but also a lot of what I'd written about and studied and taught about for years, which is this idea of democratic resilience, that a well-functioning American democracy, a constitutional democracy, can deal with incredible assaults and mistakes and injuries within through its own kind of beating heart, which are these norms and values that we all think about so much that cause democracy to function, you know, well, relatively well. And I have this idea that American democracy can be resilient through even what we saw, which was the eruption of neo-Nazism and incredible levels of violence and private militias invading a college town, that we can still persevere and become and use our and apply our resilience. So that was the kind of big idea in the book, is where does all that, what can be the purpose of something that seemed so senseless and so violent and was so impossibly hard for me to deal with at a lot of levels, and the lessons of my experience trying to lead the city, especially in this weak mayor form of government that we have, which the book spends a lot of time to. So what's the possible lessons and insights and use of all this? What's the use of it? And the subtitle really helped with the title put all that together into one overarching goal for the book.
Well, you mentioned that you had the firestorm coming, and you mentioned in the book the five brush fires that you felt made it up. Can we go down there one by one, and and I can read them to you, maybe easier, because I don't know if you have the notes on them. And these were five themes that were running through the book, in different spots, and how they didn't help your ability to lead, if you allow me to say that, because I think they were adding to the havoc, meaning confusion. That you, thank you for explaining the title to me that way, because it makes much more sense to me. The first one was conflict between freedom of speech and public safety. Do you want to address that, or do you want me to?
Yeah. I can go over all of them. The idea was that there were individual and overlapping sources of conflict within our law, government, policy, and politics, and that they resulted from tension between two irreconcilable goals, and that led in each case to friction and heat and combustion, and that they all overlapped. And all of you all were local. I don't know how much attention you were paying to these events as they were unfolding, you know, week by week and month by month. But this was, as I tried to understand, why did this get so combustible over this period of time? And keep in mind, there were three events that happened in 2017, not just the one Unite the Right rally in August. So the five were, as Peyton said, the first one was, there's a conflict in the First Amendment between public safety and freedom of speech. And explaining exactly how that played out in terms of the decision making that we could and could not make, and what we could and could not say publicly about this, and kind of reverse engineering how did it get so hot at the end, was, I thought, a very productive exercise, because it can help other cities. First of all, it can help other cities learn, but it can help us figure out the First Amendment and strike a better balance in the future. So a lot of people didn't know what was happening, because we couldn't talk about it, because I went through a lot of the particulars in this in a Wall Street Journal ideas section essay that I wrote about 2 months ago, arguing that the balance between the first, between freedom of expression, freedom of speech, and public safety tilts too far toward freedom of speech right now, and that the specific kind of gymnastics that we were forced to do in Charlottesville shows that the balance is off. So one very specific example, there's a idea in the First Amendment that applies to public officials at the city level called a credible threat. So you were only allowed to stop or interfere with a application for a permit for a free speech event if you have clear, specific evidence of an imminent incitement to or a planned unlawful act. And it has to be clear, specific, real evidence. It can't, and there's a Supreme Court case that even says that general descriptions of violence are protected constitutionally. And there was the case a couple few years ago, the Westboro Baptist Church was allowed to do the God hates fags, those awful signs they do at military funerals. And the law is really clear on this, but it created, my opinion is that courts ought to be able to admit probative evidence of likely violent conflict between groups and the consequences of that, like the cost of handling these events and the public safety costs for localities in considering whether local officials should be allowed to interfere with the time, place, manner restrictions or not allow an event to go on at all. But the book goes through what this was like on a daily basis. Like we were around a conference room table in a closed session where there were three Virginia State troopers who had been sent by Governor McAuliffe at our request to try and help us amass the evidence that we would need to relocate the Unite the Right rally. And the state troopers had access to supposedly the best intelligence that there was, and even they couldn't give us any evidence that met that credible threat standard. And this was a week, this was 10 days out from the event, and I go through the book, the police chief going around the table and asking all the city councilors, did you hear evidence of a credible threat? Did you hear evidence of a credible threat? And none of us could say that we did, so therefore we couldn't meet the threshold of canceling this event. So we had to hire an outside law firm to try and relocate it. And anyway, it's this incredibly detailed story of how things got so messy and what the law forces, the hoops you have to jump through. But that was one example of one of the brush fires that created an incredible amount of heat and friction as we went through. Do you want me, and I can go through the second one, which is the second biggest one. I think the three major ones to talk, like that I can talk about in the time we have are,
go ahead.
Yeah, race, history in public spaces, and accountability after crisis. And then the two others that I spend time on are the debate about civility and order in a time of a very intense passion in politics. And then the final one is the desire to achieve equity, but how much equity isn't a cure-all. Sometimes equity can be a destructive drive, and it can tear down things that the government is trying to do. But so let me just talk about, I don't want to go on forever and ever. But the second one is the race and statues debate. And for me, there's obviously a conflict between the groups that wanted to preserve history and add to it, and the groups that wanted to either, you know, to tear down statues or to, and not just statues. I mean, this goes throughout all aspects of how we're dealing with systemic racism and structural racism in our public spaces and through things like naming high schools. Like Peyton said, my high school in Arlington, Washington Lee, now has been changed to Washington Liberty. And we, all the different ways that we memorialize and deal with history. And I just thought, It obviously repeatedly exploded with very intense activism, very ad hominem attacks in all throughout politics in Charlottesville, including in the city council chambers. A lot of it was incredibly painful and very intense. And I think that stems from our feelings and frustrations about the state of race today against our history, I thought it was worth slowing things down and getting into the gray areas. There's a lot of attention in the book about how valuable the gray area is. Honest, candid, you know, basically recollections of what the gray area is in government and politics. There's, I talk about the idea of wrestling in the gray, because there's not a lot of books that really get into that part of leadership and that part of politics. But the ones that do, I think, are incredibly valuable to learning. And so I kind of tell the story of what was actually happening. And what happened with the Blue Ribbon Commission on Race, Memorials, Public Spaces that we set up. It was fascinating. They held 17 public hearings. They were majority African American, and a couple of the members ended up changing their position coming onto it as they held these public hearings and saying that we should, transform in place was the idea, the statue, rather than relocate it or tear it down. And there were prominent African Americans in the community that were making this argument. It was a very subtle, powerful argument that they wanted these to be teachable moments. A lot of that history has been lost because of what happened afterward. Because when, just like what happened in Charleston with Dylann Roof, when white supremacists openly seized on the statue as their symbol, and wanted to celebrate it, it became almost impossible to hold on to this prior history that happened where there was this idea of teachable moments from a large segment of the African American community. And then the Blue Ribbon Commission actually recommended to city council that the statues stay inside the city. That was the formal recommendation that they did. And they gave us two recommendations. They kind of split the baby. And all of this was incredibly messy. And the idea was to just tell it and tell what my experience was like, trying to make the best calls I could throughout all of this as both accurate history, but also as lessons for all of us as we seek to try and find the right balance here. And the city of Richmond has really struggled to find the right balance. They kind of did a split the baby approach with all the Confederate statues on Monument Avenue, and they're going to have to figure out what they're going to do now that the General Assembly has passed this law, which as a result of Charlottesville, which I mean, and that was another factor that a lot of people weren't aware of until the train had left the station, was that there was this state law that prevented any disturbance or removal with the statues. And just even dealing with the litigation there, and there was a lawsuit that was trying to impose civil liability on me and the other councilors for having voted for a scheme to relocate the statues. So that's a whole other subplot in all this. And I just wanted to get it all on paper in one place, because in the retelling of, I mean, the kind of biggest idea in this book is that the events that happened in Charlottesville are going to go down as a touchstone in modern American history. They're going to be hotly debated and combed over and examined for a long time. Like Hurricane Katrina, I go into this in this op-ed that I've written. They're kind of taking on layers of meaning over time. Spike Lee referenced Charlottesville in his movie, and Joe Biden is running about Charlottesville, and who knows what it's going to come to mean in 50 years. And so I wanted to just get everything from my perspective into one place as best as I could. The third one that I would say before we go into other things is accountability. So accountability was the clash between the desire for quick accountability and the constraints on providing it was generated unbelievable friction. And I felt it very intensely because there were a lot of people calling for my head. And there were, you know, there was this one city council meeting where you had 100 people standing up saying, Signer must go, Signer must go. And I still think that one of the most valuable things we did after all these events while I was still mayor was do this independent investigation that Tim Hafey, who was the former U.S. attorney for the Western District, did. I disagreed actually with some of the conclusions. It ended up costing three times as much as we initially thought, and it cost $300,000. There was this whole question about whether it should be covered by attorney-client privilege because it was done by a law firm. But still in all, it led to a number of people leaving the city's employment. It was very hard on me. I disagreed with some of the conclusions that it had and with how it kind of cast the scope of events. So it included this whole section criticizing me for holding the notorious Capital of the Resistance event that was about the Muslim bans. That was about religious discrimination, and there were a whole bunch of people there. But over time, that event became in kind of the narrative of that year of 2017, because it happened right at the very beginning, it became a kind of convenient beginning point to sort of look at this year of havoc. So anyway, I could quibble about that, but I thought it was very, very valuable to commission this 100-page detailed, widely critical report that included a lot of recommendations and a lot of discovery and a lot of very accurate criticisms of many people involved in this, including at the university and at the state and at the city level, because it's a guidebook for other cities and we can learn through our mistakes. And it was a good use of our taxpayer funds to do this accountability study. I talk a lot, but there was a lot of friction with it, and there was a lot of disruption in our city council chambers. It went on for a long time. I talk in the book about how much confusion there was about accountability just by the form of government we have. A lot of people didn't know about the city manager form of government, and they didn't know that the mayor is basically the mayor is the chairman of the board in the city manager form of government, but doesn't have any executive powers. The mayor is expressly disinvested from being able to tell staff what to do or command anybody. The city manager is the emergency manager for the city, the CEO of the city. But because I talk a lot in the book about how I had intentionally charted out a very proactive course for the mayorship, and I wanted to launch all these new programs and hold rallies and hire more staff and be a very public voice that was very, very proactive. That caused a lot of confusion because people, when there was a crisis, they thought that I had more power than I did to, for instance, like cancel a permit or tell the police what to do or explain why tear gas was used when the police used tear gas or lots of other things that happened during the course of that year. And you just don't have that power in the form of government. So getting again into the gray area and just telling the story, I thought was valuable about this accountability brush fire that caused a lot of the heat and the friction that erupted.
Well, I have kind of a double question that the two are related. And probably the one will do. We've heard that the current administration in DC threw out the pandemic response plan left them by Obama. Have you any insight into current Seabelt planning? Not so much on the, and this is the other part of the question, what the city government has done to decrease the chance of another Unite the Right demonstration, I'm going to say. And what I'm thinking of is you mentioned that before the event, there were no tabletop exercises. I'm retired Army. You know, I am so used to doing exercises, whether it's virtual, digital, or actual, you know, the on-the-ground exercising, that to hear that sort of disheartening. Now, I know that Obama's administration, when they were outgoing, they ran exercises for members of the Trump administration. I don't think any of them are still in the administration, but that's the point.
It's a great question. I'm looking in the book because I want to find the reference to that. Yeah, here it is. The memo that came out from DHS right before warning about exactly this was going to happen. I'll get to that in a second. So the answer is yes. I met with the city manager, Tyrone Richardson, about not just about these events, but the last chapter of the book goes into the takeaways from this project I started called Communities Overcoming Extremism, which I was supposed to be coupled with the book tour I was supposed to be doing these 6 months. I was going to be doing workshops and roundtables in cities around the country on lessons from Charlottesville and from this project. If anybody's interested, you can go to www.overcomingextremism.org, and there's a final report there that is 80 pages that contains all these lessons and case studies and best practices from cities around the country and private sector actors who have dealt with extremism in one way or another, including what Peyton just said, the importance of rehearsals and tabletops and ensuring that all the stakeholders are synced up ahead of time, which was an incredible failure of what happened in Charlottesville. So we put together this learning project out of the Anti-Defamation League, and I pulled in a number of other sponsors, including, it was bipartisan, so the Charles Koch Institute was involved, New America in Washington, the National Immigration Forum, a whole host of other organizations were involved in this. And we did two summits and got other mayors together and private sector leaders to learn from what had happened. I gave the city manager a copy of our report and we had a meeting about it. And he said, his specific concern was, I don't want to betray any confidence, but we were talking about scenarios this year. You know, if the General Assembly, I guess a specific concern would be because the General Assembly passed this law allowing the statue to be removed, what if there is some renewed protest that happens around that? The city has already done a really good job with this Unity Days program, which basically in a community-driven way programs all activities in all of the parks for weeks leading up to the anniversary of Unite the Right in August. So the parks are legitimately occupied with community-driven programming around Unity. So there is no way that the parks could be used for a permanent event because there's pre-existing activity happening in them that is for legitimate purposes that the community deems valuable. So that happened last year, and it was very successful. So there, I think the city has done a good job of avoiding the concern about the city kind of being invaded again at each of the August anniversaries. But there's the other concern about what lessons does the city take for what if there's a massive invasion of the city by right-wing forces, or militias again around the statue. What if that happens again? And I took the city manager through a lot of the lessons from the project. And I, you know, talk in the book about how I've met with other mayors around the country. The mayor of Louisville called me one time and said, well, what are the key takeaways? Because they had a potential conflict between a militia group and an anti-ICE group happening. And I said, well, here's five, tabletopping, communications, prioritizing communications, honest communications with the citizenry and with stakeholders. One of the things that was most frustrating to me, and again, this was an area where the gray area just is messy and awful to go through, but it was why things ended up the way they did, was we could not get our act together on communication. And the city councilors wanted to have daily press briefings the 2 weeks before the event, the staff wouldn't do it. And we even hired a strategic communications firm from DC that came down, and the Monticello Fund, the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, Monticello gave half of the $10,000 fee. So these two people could be down here for 5 days to help the city with its strategic crisis communications. Cause we knew from the experience of the two other events that this could be a real black mark on the city's reputation, and that the citizens would need to know what was happening. And the staff refused to work with them. They said, this is a city council priority. We are working with the state's emergency communications people. We won't let these experts be even in the command center. And so one of the reasons that we were so quiet and so non-communicative was because of all this. So I told the city manager, and what I've told other mayors is you have to make a priority of Folsom, you know, even if it's vulnerable, accurate communications with the public that connect. And I think it's one of the reasons that in this COVID crisis, there has been such high ratings for people like Andrew Cuomo, who have been telling, for the most part, really bad news to their public. So communications, tabletopping. I talk a lot about one of the lessons is trying to maintain good lines of communication with the groups One of the problems with the Unite the Right rally was because of the mishandling of the KKK rally, and talk a lot about the use of tear gas there and the kind of stories and the lack of accountability for why tear gas was used. There was any bridge between the anti-fascist protesters and the police was destroyed. So there was no communication between them. And that was really problematic. So the police have to have as much communication with the groups as they possibly can. Another thing was don't get into standoffs. There were problems that happened in Charlottesville because of turf standoffs, allowing fuses to get very short. And one of the secrets with a lot of this is just avoiding standoffs. That was what happened after the KKK rally, where there was a conflict between the police and the counter protesters. And one of the problems that happened with the Unite the Right was just the sequencing of things that happened. There wasn't really a plan after the rally was disbanded for how to safely separate the protesters and the counter protesters. There wasn't a plan before. And this came up in the Hafey report. They were even allowed to mix and mingle at the parking garage. And, it was disastrous. So you really have to have a plan for before, during, and after these events can happen and stick to it. And, so that's another thing was standoffs can happen after an event, but you have to think before, during, and after and have a strategy that really has played out as many unintended consequences as you can and has thought through very practical things like parking, water, bathrooms. It turns out that, if we tried to relocate the rally and we lost in federal court on the eve of the event. And we're sued in part because of how strict these First Amendment, the case law is. Because the First Amendment law says, events that are about issues need to be close to the physical object that they're concerned with. So the Supreme Court cases say if there's a free speech event about a statue, it needs to be close to the statue. We actually had an idea that this is an interesting detail in the book that a former law professor of mine at UVA named Vince Blasi, who's at Columbia part-time, he had suggested in a call I did with him that we could create a system of rotating shuttles where you would have the major events would be at McIntyre Park where we wanted to move them, but you'd enable some of the protesters through a shuttle system to go to the Lee statue and spend 15 minutes there and then be shuttled back to McIntyre Park. That's how strict a lot of the law is. And we couldn't get staff to adopt that idea or to seriously explore it. But with the event happening ultimately in a crowded urban location like downtown Charlottesville, which was what the city councilors wanted to avoid and why we hired this outside law firm to try and move it, because it just seemed like it was going to be so dangerous. And then ultimately it was as dangerous as we feared. You have to do what the Hafey report recommended, which is a stadium plan. And that's what's happened at the subsequent anniversaries or the 1 year anniversary. If everybody remembers, everybody said the police response was so militarized, but that's basically because they constructed a perimeter around the entire downtown mall area. And we passed a new permitting law that allowed for the prohibition of anything that could potentially be used as a weapon other than a firearm, because Virginia law prohibits that, inside the whole downtown mall area. And there were all these concrete jersey barriers that had to be constructed so that there was one fixed point of entry and exit, or fixed points of entry and exit that the police could monitor. That didn't happen at the Unite the Right rally. There were dozens of points of entry and exit because they didn't create a perimeter because it was so complicated and expensive to plan for a perimeter. But that's ultimately, if you're going to have a rally like this in a crowded urban area, that's what you have to do. It's called a stadium plan. So those are some specific takeaways. And I took the city manager through a lot of these and thinking about, well, what if one of these happened, unfortunately, again in Charlottesville. And I know it's definitely caused some heartburn in trying to think about it. And hopefully the state police and the university and the city would be, adopt all the lessons that came out of the Hafey report, the book, everything else, and in planning for another one of these events. God forbid.
Hey, Peyton, do you want to open it up for chats from the rest of the participants, if they'll send to you or to me their questions?
Oh, yes. That's what I was hoping, was that you were getting questions from the others. I'm reading the ones you've got. I've got them up that you've sent. And, in fact, I'm going to ask Mike now if he can talk about why the actions of Friday night didn't affect the law enforcement on Saturday morning.
Great. It's a great question, and it was one of the most searing parts of the book to recount for me. The book goes into very painful detail on exactly what happened on Friday night from my perspective as the mayor in this former government. So, and maybe again in the future, if something like this happened, they could use the lessons of this. So Terry Sullivan at UVA, I mean, first of all, we found out that we had lost the court case, I think at about like 8 o'clock, and I was in the church service, Unity Church Service downtown, and digested the news, went home to try and figure out what would we say and do about this. And then right after that, I was at home when I got the news from somebody that the Daily Progress website was showing what was happening on grounds with the torch rally and the procession and all the violence that then started happening. And I called Pat Hogan, who was the COO of the university, and he wasn't watching it. He said, "I've heard that everything is fine." And then I said, "Look at the Daily Progress website right now." And he did. And then he said, "I got to get off the phone. I got to call the chief of police." There was even, and some of the investigations at the university have gotten in a lot more detail about what was happening there around the handling and the knowledge about this event. Terry Sullivan texted me at like maybe 9:30 at night and said, we should go back into court for reconsideration based on new evidence of the decision in federal court. And I talked to her, and that was, and got right on the phone with our counsel in the city. And I go through this in the book. I mean, it was very difficult. And I said, here's what happened at the university. Everybody was looking at it, and I hadn't gotten any kind of information call. And again, that's because there's no real reason for the mayor to get that, because the mayor doesn't have any power to command or direct anything on the eve of a big event. The city manager is the emergency manager for the city. But I got the call from the president of the university. So I called the general counsel and said, "It looks like UVA wants to go to court. What do you think about that? And it looks like we have new evidence that could maybe get this federal judge." And he basically said no, that this event is scheduled to start at tomorrow morning. I don't know how we would get a judge to rule on it. And he was demoralized and exhausted, because you had this office of four attorneys that have been working until midnight dealing with all this litigation the prior week. And this is one of the things with a small city getting overwhelmed. You know, I talked to our current attorney in the city, and he says that he would have filed for an emergency injunction. He would have gone right into federal court and tried to get the judge on the phone, you know, basically, and get the permit overturned based on the evidence of what had happened at the university. But that's with the benefit of hindsight, and our attorney now doesn't know what it would have been like to have been dealing with understaffed attorney's office, dealing with 6 weeks of chaos the 6 weeks before. And, you know, but hope in the future, maybe. So anyway, that's what happened. I even got on the phone to the chief deputy attorney general. I called the governor. I called the attorney general, because what would have needed to have happened, because the city wasn't willing to do this. Then when I talked to Terry Sullivan, the university is represented by the attorney general in Virginia, so that they represent all public agencies. So talked to the chief deputy attorney general and said, "You represent the university, the city. I think I can get the city councilors to be on board with anything legally to try and stop this thing tomorrow." And then she said, "Well, we're interested, but we represent the university, so you're not our client. You need to talk." So they did talk, from what I understand. And then Terry, I think because it didn't make a lot of sense probably in this crucible for the university to be trying to change an event that was happening in the city, primarily for the university to be playing the lead. And because the city wasn't willing, and I'd called the city manager, and I think everybody was basically asleep because they were going to be up at 5 the next morning for all the briefings that were starting, and had lost this very demoralizing federal case. So that's what happened. That's what happened. And in the future, I think that a city ought to try to file for an emergency injunction in federal court on the basis of new evidence to get them to reconsider.
Forgot, I mute myself in between while you're speaking just so that you don't hear me cough anything. One more question for me, and hopefully there are more coming in that Rich is monitoring. We have a paramilitary law in Virginia.
Yes.
Can you speak a little bit on that? Because I've read the citation. Of course, I'm an ecologist. I'm not a lawyer.
Yeah. No, it's. I thank you for asking that question. One of the one of the lessons that came out of this, and that we highlighted a lot in the Communities Overcoming Extremism project, and that one of the things there's a lot I'm not proud of. There's a lot about recounting this experience that was, just to be honest with you all, just awful and very difficult for my family. These events were and just very, just really challenging. But so it's hard to crow and try to take a lot of credit for great things that happened, because there was so much mess in all this. But there were some things that I was very proud of still. And one of them was this lawsuit that we filed with Georgetown University. There's an Institute of Constitutional Advocacy and Protection there. This was 2 months after the Unite the Right rally. And there is a provision in Virginia's constitution that basically makes militia paramilitary groups and activity illegal. So you have to have permission from the civilian authority. And this goes back to the original constitution from the 18th century. Back when this fragile new democracy was very concerned about paramilitary groups, you didn't have the state having a monopoly on force back then. And so that is in Virginia's constitution. It had never been, or very, from what we understand, very rarely been referenced before. And so, but now what happened in the Unite the Right rally was you had 11 or 12 paramilitary groups. These are militias that came constituted as a militia. I mean, they had insignia and they had weaponry. They had command structures. They went on sorties. They protected certain areas. So they were conducting themselves like paramilitary groups, and they met all of the standards, legal standards for a paramilitary group. So we filed this lawsuit, and we had to get co-plaintiffs, and then Georgetown went to work, and they did incredible legal work. And we sued all of these groups. They all ultimately charging them with having violated this provision. And the demand, the legal goal was to prevent them from coming back to the city. And all of them, it was amazing to watch, like, basically lawless groups comply with law. So they had to come into court. They had to get lawyers. They had to comply with discovery requests. And they all ultimately agreed to binding consent decrees where they agreed not to come back to the city as militias. So that meant they couldn't come back in groups of two or more with the markers of a militia group. So that's one of the reasons that at the August 1 year anniversary, the city was safe. I think it's one of the reasons that none of the groups came back. Those consent decrees are still in place, by the way. That's one of the reasons that, one of the things I talked to the city manager about, they still may not come back to Charlottesville as a militia group. And one of the reasons that this was so important was, you all may remember in October, I think it was October, it was the flash mob. There was a rally where Richard Spencer, who is the guy who started a lot of this, came back to the city with another group of his followers with tiki torches, and they came to the Lee statue, and they called it a flash mob, and they did these crazy songs, and they chanted "Russia is our friend," and were basically refusing to be controlled by the city. So there was this real day, and he said, "We're gonna make this a war zone. We're gonna be back. So many times your head will spin." And he was really threatening to make Charlottesville this constant kind of stage for these groups. And That was one of the reasons that in the permitting overhaul that we passed, which is another one of the things I was very proud of doing, we had to have a whole other law firm have us help us. We crafted it so that you no longer can have tiki torches at public parks in Charlottesville, but you can still have candlelight vigils, which is tricky. So it's written in such a way that it literally regulates the kind of lit equipment you can have so that you can't have these instruments of, you know, terror, like torches, a visual terror and intimidation any longer. But there was a real fear that this would be an ongoing thing. So we, that was why that lawsuit was so powerful. And they used it in Dayton, Ohio. They've used it in a few other places. And the center has gone on to really play this leading role in advising all these cities on how to be kind of innovative within the rule of law to protecting democracy.
Well, I think I only have time for one more question from the audience. Based on your experience, do you think the Charlottesville form of government is good as it is, or what changes would you suggest?
That's an awesome question. I go into this in the book. We had this whole debate I finished, as you all may know, I finished my term as mayor, which was a 2-year term, and stayed on city council for the remaining 2 years. And we had repeated debates after my term ended with Nikaya Walker as mayor about whether we should have a strong mayor form of government, whether we should change the government, which would be very hard to do under Virginia law. You'd have to get permission from the General Assembly to do it. And my opinion, despite everything that I'd been through and all the frustrations I had with the former government, was that because of the size of Charlottesville, we should have an elected city manager. That was my opinion. So they do that in Maryland. The city manager is elected, and they do it in some other around the country where the chief executive of a locality will be an elected position. Obviously, different states do this different ways. Some judges are elected, which we don't do in Virginia. But I thought that would be the mechanism that would address the concern without, to me, in Virginia, with the size of Charlottesville being 50,000, I couldn't see how we would create a strong mayor without upending everything, because then you'd have to make it a full-time paid position, and then you'd have to have the city councilors somehow dealt with in that way. Richmond is a strong mayor form government. It's the only one in Virginia, but Richmond's totally different. It's a capital city of a couple hundred thousand people, and it has a level of infrastructure that I think, and Doug Wilder had gotten that done there. And I talked during the debates that we had in the dais about making the city manager elective, but that nobody wanted to do that in that city council that I was on. Nikaya Walker wanted to be, you know, to have the mayorship be paid a lot more, and to and there were some of her supporters who were kind of pressing for a strong mayor from a government, I think, because they wanted her to be a strong mayor. And you know, I don't make any bones about it. We had a lot of differences of opinion about a lot of things, and I was concerned about, and I talked a lot about this one during the last city council term. I was concerned about what that strong mayorship would have been like also. But I just didn't think it was a good idea for a city of 50,000. I thought we should elect the city manager. And other than that, the city should be way, way more clear. And I know that on the website now, I haven't looked at it recently, but they told me that they were going to try to be much more clear with the citizens about who has what responsibilities, and that the city managers have been doing a lot more outreach to the population and to journalists so that they understand. And if you've even seen a lot of the stories that have happened during Mayor Walker's term, they've explained and gone out of their way to include another paragraph where it'll say the mayor in Charlottesville is largely a ceremonial position. So at least the public has some proactive guidance about who to look to actually effect some direct change or to express frustrations to about something operational. And I think a lot of that also has come out of this experience. But I still think it would be a really cool thing to elect a city manager. I think that it would provide the most direct accountability in a smaller city that you could. You know, it'd be very innovative, but there wasn't any interest in that.
Well, Mike, I want to thank you. I'm know you've got another call at 2:30, so I want to get you out a couple of minutes ahead of time. But I want to thank you for having participated. And will you give the URL for the buying the book?
I also want to say
that we have a small gift for you that we'll get to you when this is over with.
I'm in my home office right now, as you can probably tell, and I look out a window this direction, and as we were having the last 20 minutes, I just saw a UPS guy drop off some kind of package at the front door with his mask on, so we're all getting our maybe the best thing to do is, can everybody see the chat down there? Do you all, because I can send around, or maybe you can send around the,
I can
send it out to everybody. And this includes purchase links, for the book in it. And, some people don't like to use, I can send it out. Let's see. Oh, no, I can only email both of you through this. So
I'm trying to, one more second. I'll open it up.
Okay. But I would also ask, it's a very, very tough time for new books. This book came out on March 10th, and I would really appreciate it if every one of you would consider purchasing the book, whether on Amazon or on one of the other Barnes & Noble or when the bookstores reopen, or buying a Kindle version or buying an audiobook. There's 30 people here. So publishers are very frightened and scared right now about what's happened to the book market because nonfiction books like this. So I would really appreciate it if you would buy it. And if you use Amazon, putting up reviews on Amazon really matters because people look there. And this book had the misfortune to come out literally the day before the shutdown started. So hopefully we're going to start the book tour again in August and September, and I'll be able to go out there more. There's been a lot of, the New York Times was supposed to review it, and I was interviewed on NPR as All Things Considered and lots of things like that, but all of that has gotten postponed because of this coronavirus. So I just really am grateful for any attention that you guys can give to it, including just buying it and reading it and telling people about it. And we all have more time to read nowadays through the anxiety and the craziness of this new time. So I am so grateful for this opportunity. I really it's really nice to talk to locals about this. And I hope that, it's been very healing and therapeutic for me and my wife to be able to talk about this, and to get as much of the story out as we could, as I could, and try and be constructive with it, and try and generate as much learning from it as I can. So I view all these as a great opportunity. And if anybody wants to get in touch with me afterward, my personal email is msignor.author@gmail.com. Anything. I've got lots of time to respond to questions now. And that's my author one. So msignor.author@gmail.com. And my personal website is michaelsignor.com. And there's a lot more information on there. And I appreciate reading it, buying it, telling people about it, questions, anything is great.